So today I'm on time. It's now 8 o'clock. So welcome to today's talk. Today is Wednesday. So this is Wednesday talk. So that when you, if you don't have a timer, at least you know it's Wednesday sometime. So welcome to today's talk. Yesterday when I gave a talk, on the insight. But the type of insight I talked about yesterday was the big ones. And of course we use insight all the way, you know, from the very beginnings of the meditation right to the very ends of meditation. For example, even just getting to be aware of your breath. Some people find it difficult to be aware of your breath. And sometimes why? It never means you're not putting enough effort in. It's usually you put too much effort in, which is that's one of the reasons why. So if the mind can't get rested and get still. And of course the first insight is to get good instructions, simple instructions, not controversial instructions. And one of those instructions is please to know that when we do samatha vipassata, samatha does not mean sort of concentration. So please, if you can, just wipe that, delete that from your brain. It does mean stillness. And the very fact of when you start to understand the meditation of stillness, that changes a lot. How can you be still? And to be still, you need to be aware of the cause of stillness. That's the insight into the cause of stillness and why that sometimes that stillness just doesn't happen. Why? And a simple way of remembering that is a phrase which I've used very often. Relax to the max. And I remember that similarly because when I really made a lot of emphasis on it was when I went to South Korea a few years ago. I've been there quite a few times now. But when I went there, it was for a special ceremony just by the DMZ, the Demilitarized Zone. And just, we did even have a walk within the DMZ. They wanted one of the monks, Ajahn Gunha was there, I was there, and there was this senior Jogche Order monk who was there. But guess who drew the short straw and had to do the walk? That was me. It was about I forget how many kilometers it was, about 3 or 4 hours. And it was within the demilitarized zone. I was shot many times. Click. Click. I can't avoid making jokes and videos. So we had permission, so it was reasonably safe. But anyway, I do sort of remember after doing that walk with everybody. You know, one of the interesting insights on that walk, it's not really what I wanted to talk about, but it's interesting, that after half an hour, I got tired. And the person who was leading it, that was Gaksan, you know, he was organizing everything, and being the organizer, he was in a little buggy or in a car later on. And he kept on saying, Ajahn Brahm, are you okay? Are you too tired? Do you want to finish now and we can drive you back? And there came a time when I really was tired. You know what I did? I decided instead of just getting in the buggy or something and going back, let's speed up. I started walking faster. It's a weird experience because, you know, sometimes I love rebelling and doing things you're not supposed to do which aren't supposed to work. So I sped up, started walking faster. And as soon as I put more effort into my walking, I had way more energy. And I was really breezing along and just walking quite fast. And so the 3 or 4 hour walk sort of, you know, finished quite quickly. And yeah, I could feel I'd just done a lot of exercise, but I always remember the monks behind me, there was a couple of Thai monks walking with me, and they didn't realize I could understand Thai, and they said, this is Kung Fu. I I don't know what it was, but it certainly worked. But anyway, when we finished, you know, I was only there for a couple of days. It's actually during the rains retreat, I think, so I just managed to take the 7-day allowance to do that ceremony for Venerable Gaksan. And then I had to go back to the airport to get a flight back to Perth. And they said it was about 6,000 South Koreans had gone on a walk with me, and they'd all come back, and they were sitting there in front of the stage. And Venerable Gaksan said, could you please give them some last words before you leave? Something to remember you by. I said, yeah, sure, easy. And then I said, my last words to you are, relax. And then Venerable Gaksan translated into Korean how they would understand that. But I said, no, you say it now. So I had all these 6,000 South Koreans saying, relax. And then to the max, he translated it. Now, all of you, to the max. So there's 6,000 to the max. Okay, say it together. Relax to the max. Okay, bye-bye. And of course they laughed. They didn't realize it's much more, much deeper than just telling a funny story. I knew they would remember that. And that's an important part of the meditation. People think, relax the max. Now, meditation is fierce. If you want to get something, you've really got to put everything into it. Yes, relax to the max. And you know that's a very powerful teaching. So when you start meditating, are you relaxed? Do you even know what relaxed is? To the max. So this is actually where we start the meditation, having a body which is really at ease. Probably what I'm doing. So it feels good, because when it's relaxed, it doesn't cause you any problems. So you can let it go. If you're at your workplace, your office, or wherever you work, if you're going to come on a retreat, you're going to make sure that everything's settled in the office before you actually leave it and come to a retreat. The last thing you want is somebody trying to contact you because they can't find something. So that's why you make sure everything is settled. Like when you leave your body to do some nice meditation, you've got to make sure everything in your body is good enough, it's all settled, it won't go wrong. And then you can have a nice free time. For those of you who came here in a car, you know, you park your car in the car park, you lock it up, you make sure everything is fine in there, it's nice and settled, and once it's settled, you can lock it up, you can walk away and leave it there for 9 days without any worries at all. That's like with your body, relaxing it to the max, and then you find it's easy. The body just doesn't disturb you. I know that sometimes people have like feelings coming up in the body, or itches in the body, or aches in the body, or winds going through the body. It's kind of okay, because it's natural, but it's much better to let the body look after the body. You know, whenever you get sick, sometimes you just, I let the body look after it, look after me. I don't know why I have all these theories of what I should do and how I should act and what I should take and what I should not take and how much I should do and what I shouldn't do. I have all these theories. But years ago I realized those are my theories. You read articles, you'd actually done some research, but the one thing which I had never done was ask my body, body, what do you want to do? Now, asking your body how it feels, what it wants to do, that is another definition or explanation of what mindfulness is. You don't assume you have it right, you ask. If I want to find out how you are, I don't just look at you and assume I know what's going on. I ask, how are you feeling today? When you ask, you get an answer. That's like the process of mindfulness and getting the response. But you've got to ask first. So I spend a lot of time just learning how to ask my body and respond. Some of the people who visited Bodhinyana a couple of days ago. They were very distraught because they had a little dog, and unfortunately the dog had cancer and they had to euthanize it, put it down. And they were still very, very distraught about that. And being strict Buddhists, they sort of asked, now, did we do the right thing? You know, we're not supposed to kill any animals. But, you know, our dog was suffering. We were conflicted between not killing anything but being compassionate. So what should you do? And again, what you do, and it works really well, you ask the dog. It's not a joke. You take the dog into a corner and just hold it, look it in its eyes. This dog you've known for years. And you ask the dog, do you want to die? Or do you want to carry on? It's your choice. And it is the dog's choice. That is wonderful experiences and tales when you do this. Did I tell this story before? Okay, it was in town. I get confused because I give stories over here, talks over there, and I don't know what I talked here and talked over there. I'm always giving talks. Sometimes I reckon if I don't have an opportunity to give a talk when I go to bed at night, I talk in my sleep. I'll probably give a Dhamma talk. I'm so used to it. But anyway, this was, some of you may know this lady, Judy, her name was. She had a nice little dog. I think it was over in Mundaring. And the dog had cancer. And eventually, tried to treat it. Doesn't matter how much it costed, it was worth it, because she loved her dog. And then after a while, the vet told her that nothing more we can do. So the vet said to Judy, I need your permission to euthanize the dog, to put it down. And because she'd heard me tell her what to do, she just said, can I spend a few moments with my dog first? So she went into a quiet room, just the two of them, the dog and Judy. She held her dog. She made her mind peaceful. And then she said to the dog, do you want to die or do you want to carry on? And she got the message back. The dog didn't want to die yet. Wanted to carry on. So she went to the vet. And you know, she was actually sure of that. This is someone you've lived with and cared for such a long time. You do have sensitivity to them. And when she asked a question, she got the answer, no. So what happened next? She went to see the vet in the next room and said, oh, can I put it down? And Judy said, no, I'm taking the dog home. And at that, the vet knew that Judy was a Buddhist. And then he started to criticize her. You Buddhists are supposed to be compassionate, but when it really comes down to it, you're just thinking of yourself. You're really cruel. This dog is really hurting. It's not going to survive. You're just torturing it even more. You know, you Buddhists are just so cruel. You say you're compassionate, but are you? Really scolded her. But you know, she was strong enough. She took the dog home. But she did have the opportunity to take the dog to the vet 6 months later. It made a full recovery by itself. And so he took it to the vet. Is this the same dog? Yeah, it's the same dog. You Buddhists are so wise. They managed to actually see something much deeper. And that's what mindfulness does. Even in you. I've done this before, and sometimes, you know, you get somebody who's in the ICU, who's comatose, and the doctor asks you, you know, this is your father, shall I turn off the machines and let him die? What do you do? Yeah, I think you nuns know that happened to one of your friends at Dharamsala. Father very sick in hospital, comatose. And then So for us, actually not the father, it's her mum. And then she asked me, what should I do? I said, go and stand next to your mum and ask her, are you still there? How do you feel? And eventually she did that, and the time came. She asked me, because I was visiting. And then I just sat next to the bed, made my mind peaceful and calm. And then I told her that, you know, your mum is just so exhausted and tired, she wants to die. And that's not psychic powers, it's just being sensitive. And so, you know, she admitted that, and I came to see her again when I next visited a week or two later. And this time when I sat next to the bed, she's already gone. The stream of consciousness has left the body. She's died. But the machines are keeping her carrying on. And so she didn't actually ask the doctors to stop the life support system, but the woman actually died that night. And it was very wonderful because I'd been part of that I could do the funeral service for her, which I was very privileged to do. But anyway, if you ask the questions, you get some really interesting answers. If that's your mother or father or sister somewhere in hospital, and you want to know, what the heck am I supposed to do? Just be quiet. Just maybe hold her hand or something, get some contact, and ask her the question, Dad, are you still there? And you will know if the body is just being kept alive by the machines, or whether they really have gone, or whether they're still alive, maybe come back again later on. So you get the answers. And it's also with your body as well. I do that a lot whenever I can. You know, I am old now, and I do work hard. And sometimes I ask myself, if I have a free morning, Ajahn Brahm, how do you feel? And I listen, feel my body. A lot of time my body says, oh fine, just carry on. But every now and again, my body says, no, you need a rest. I'm sensitive enough that I can feel that. So then I go back to my room and just lay down. I'm in a cave, you'll see that cave this afternoon. No one knows what I do inside that cave. It's all soundproof. No windows or anything, so I go in there, and if I need to rest, I rest. I lay down, and I know it's the right time, because I've been doing it for such a long time, I can feel it. Am I indulging, or is this really important? And so often you lay down, and maybe 5-10 seconds, or maybe less than that, when your head hits the pillow, you're fast asleep. You're resting. Half an hour, 45 minutes later, you open your eyes and you feel just so energized. I always think of it as my body says, thank you. You've given me a chance to have a rest to overcome some disease which was going around. And if you doubt me, just ask any of the monks in Bodhinyana Monastery, when was the last time Ajahn Brahm was sick? All the other monks get sick. I don't. So anyway, because of that, I trust my body when I'm mindful of it. And I get the insight into being kind to it. If that's what my body needs, fine. So this is the beginnings of insight. Insight into having a calm and healthy body. So then you can sit down, if you need to sit down, or stand up or lie down, whatever you're doing. And then you can ask your body, body, we need to meditate now. Have you heard me say this before? Sometimes I ask my body and my mind, what do you want to do now? Do you want to just sit down and have a glass of water, or go for a little stroll, or go and explore some of the flowers or the birds? In the grounds here, what do you want to do? And because I trust my body, My body never wants to indulge and waste time and do stupid things, but it always wants to do innovative things. And it means that I can enjoy, my body enjoys. It means we are good friends. So when you learn how to relax to the max, you are being a friend to your body, not sort of a control freak. And that is also, you get the insight that being a friend rather than a controller is a way to peace. As I said last night, you don't defeat Mara by kicking his butt, by taking him and strangling him, by pounding him, by, I don't know what else you can do, I'm not a violent monk. But anyway, you overcome Mara by understanding Mara, by wisdom. And a lot of diseases, illnesses, you can overcome not by force, but by understanding. It's one of the reasons why, ever since I started going to the cancer care place, I always said, please don't fight cancer. If you do battle with it, the likelihood is you're going to lose. Understand it. Use wisdom power, never willpower. And on that, I just remember just some of the anecdotes. This lady over in Malaysia, she was an oncologist, right word, but a cancer doctor specialist. But anyway, that she was about to retire, she had a few months left, and she talked to me about her practice, and she said something which really took my attention. She said, after all these years of practicing with cancer patients, that now I can tell 95% accuracy who's going to survive and who's going to die soon. Just not by their CT scans or by their x-rays or by other test results, just by their attitude. I don't care whether it's stage 1, 2, 3, 4 or whatever. Just their attitude is a much better indicator of whether they're going to survive or not. And I really appreciated that, because this is where you find with many diseases, you get the insight. It's the attitude, how the mind reacts to it and reacts to life, is a much more accurate indicator of your health and survival than anything else. So anyway, those are just anecdotes. But you do get insights into just, you know, how to have a peaceful, strong body, and if that's at all possible. And even if you have chronic pain, you can still also not fight the pain. That's probably what caused the chronic pain to begin with, fighting it. But to understand it, let it teach you. That's also one of the reasons why when I was developing that meditation of the Emperor's Three Questions, sometimes people say, yes, now's the most important time, yeah, of course. The thing in front of you is the most important, but sometimes it's unpleasant. Do you mean, Ajahn Brahm, that I'm really in pain, I just got to be with that pain? Yeah. And understand it. All these unpleasant experiences in life, when we run away from them, it's like we have a test and we have to go and do it again next week if we don't do it now. So after a while, everything which comes up in your life is like a teacher to us. So if there is a pain, you've got to learn something from that. And just being with it and being kind to it, caring for it, open the door of your heart to this experience, that's where you learn the best. And it's amazing what you can learn. These insights aren't ordinary insights. It's not just coming and going, passing away. It's just why they stay. Why they feel so painful. Why that sometimes they don't. You get so much really, not just interesting, but useful information about your body and how to look after it. That means you learn how to relax the body to the max. And of course, the next thing to do, that's so important. Often I kind of wondered why the Buddha said that you should always start your meditation with kayagata sati, the mindfulness of the body practice. I don't need to do that. Just go straight onto the breath. I want to get straight into the nimittas. Don't waste time. Come on, let's do the fast track meditation. But then you realize that this is the fast track. To be able to just watch your body, first of all, to prepare the mind for the meditation. You know, I've done lots of building in this, in my life as a Buddhist monk. The most important part of the building is always a preparation. You know, to make sure you've got really good foundations, you know, to build the structure. To make sure before you paint, you remove all the grease, you know, from the wall. It's clean. So if you're making a garden, to make sure, most of the work in the garden is not planting the seeds, it's preparing the soil. Enough water, there's enough nutriment there. Enough sun, not too much. The preparation is important. The same with meditation. Yeah, these monks come up and say, jhanas, it's really easy. All you need to do is to go into the nimitta and just really go in. Just watch your lotus with loving kindness and mindfulness. You just do that and the lotus will open. Sounds really easy, doesn't it? The most important part of that is the preparation. Making sure you do have strong enough mindfulness and strong enough kindfulness to be able to focus that on the lotus and not to interfere when it starts to open up. Sometimes these meditations are fascinating. At first they don't go according to what you think are the rules. It works another way. And that's where you get the insight into how meditation works. It's one of the reasons why Ajahn Chah told me when I first became a monk, you know, I repeat stories. Because I remember Ajahn Chah would repeat stories. He'd have one story, he'd tell it again and again and again for about a month, and then another story would take precedence. And then another story. And this particular story, he only told, I think, the first two or three weeks when I went to Wat Pa Phong, translated, you know, from the Thai into English. And then at first when I heard this particular story, I thought was absolute rubbish. I said, no way could this have any meaning. But I'll say what happened afterwards. I'll say what the story is first. It was a story that Wat Pa Phong was a mango orchard. And the mango trees had been planted by the Buddha himself. Now I know that many people like to believe that the Buddha went to this country and that country. But it's a bit sort of dodgy, there's no real strong evidence there. But nevertheless, I'm pretty sure that the Buddha never went to Wat Pa Phong in northeast Thailand. And if he did, he wouldn't be planting mango trees there. But anyway, that's what Ajahn Chah was saying, so that turned me off to begin with. And then he said, now, all these mango trees are mature and ripe. Mature, they'd be dead by now, 2,500 years. And they're full of ripe, juicy, sweet mangoes. And I did pay attention there because, you know, these were the early days in northeast Thailand. I was hungry. You talk about food and I would listen. It's true. Have some compassion. And then he said, this is Ajahn Chah, said, if you try and throw a stick up at those mangoes to try and knock one down, you will never be able to knock them down. If you shake the tree, the mangoes won't fall. If you try and climb up the tree, you never reach them. If you try and get a ladder, the ladder is not tall enough to reach them. There's only one way, Ajahn Chah said, to get any of those mangoes. They're sweet and delicious, so many of them. There's only one way to reach them. That's to sit underneath the mango tree, perfectly still. Hold out a hand, and a mango will fall. Such is the wisdom and compassion of the Buddha. Have you ever sat under a mango tree? Have you ever held up your hand, it's going to fall? I was a scientist. This was illogical, irrational. This will never happen. So I forgot it. I thought I'd forgotten it. But this is a wonderful thing about Dhamma. Even some of the stuff which I've said here, some of the, oh, that's rubbish. You know, talking about jhanas, I'm just so far away from those things. What's he talking about that for? I talk about that because some of this stuff gets into your brain and you remember it. It gets stored away in a little corner. You don't realize it's stored away there. And then one day, when you're getting close to these great experiences in meditation, that information comes up. Just like the seeds in the middle of Australia's deserts. They stay there for years. And then one day there's a rainstorm comes there, and all those seeds, they sort of come to fruition. That is just like some of the Dhamma which is taught. You may reject it, you may think this is silly, this doesn't make any sense. But it stays in your brain somewhere, in your mind. And later on in your life, or maybe later on today, I'm not sure, that something clicks and you remember, I remember that now. The only way to get some of those beautiful fruits of the practice is to sit perfectly still. Opening up your hand is opening up the mind with kindness. The door of my hand is perfectly open. Please come in. That's when the mango falls. So you find, yes, you get frustrated. Yeah, 4 or 5 days, nothing's happened yet. Ajahn Brahm, what am I going to tell my friends? Nine days on retreat, it was just so hard to get into this. And what do you get afterwards? Nothing. Oh, that just really sucks. So don't allow that wanting to come in. Carry on sitting as still as you can. Relax to the max. Not wanting anything in the whole world. Open the heart with kindness. And you'll be amazed what falls in through your hand. That's why I say it is easy. When you stop trying. The hardest thing is to stop trying. You're such addicted triers. And sometimes we don't even know what it's like when we don't do anything. Sometimes you do, because a few of you have said that sometimes, you know, you just gave up. That's one of the best ways to let go. Just give up. Look, you've been meditating for how many days now? 4 or 5, nothing's happened, and you expect something to happen now? It won't happen. Give up. Some of you have been coming here for years and you've got nothing. And you expect something to happen now? Of course not. So give up. Just come and sit and just kill time. And that's when things happen. It's weird. It's surprising. But after you've experienced that, you know exactly why. For once you did sit perfectly still, without trying to get anything, without trying to make anything happen. You were peaceful, and you were kind. Whatever happens is fine. And that's when these beautiful fruits drop. So those are insights which sometimes are unbelievable, but they actually do happen, and that's what makes it wonderful. To understand it even more deeply, because I have got an inventive mind, so I do develop some similes, and this is one of my favourite similes because it's fun. It's a story of the donkey and the carrot. I think maybe some of you have heard me so many times. You should get like a list of your favourite similes. That'll be up in there in the top 10, I'm sure. The donkey and the carrot. Now, any of you have ever seen a donkey, the donkey is one of the most stubborn animals in the whole world. If you think you've got a stubborn wife or a stubborn husband, they're never as stubborn as a donkey. I don't want to offend anybody, but I think you know what I mean. Even Ajahn Brahm, am I stubborn? Be honest. Yes, I agree. So, sometimes what farmers do, they take a stick and try and hit the donkey to get it to move. But the donkey has got a lot of endurance. You can hit it and it still won't move. Now don't try that on me, please. So instead, you don't hit the donkey with the stick, you tie the stick to the donkey's neck. So the front of the stick is about 2 foot in front of the donkey's head. On the end of the stick, you put a string. On the end of the string, you put a carrot. If it is a donkey from Penang, then you put a piece of durian. Or Indonesia. Whatever the donkey likes. So there, you see. If it's Ajahn Brahm, you put a tin of condensed milk. No, that doesn't work in this city, but like a carrot, you put a carrot in it. Now what does the donkey do? It sees a carrot just 2 foot in front of its mouth. The donkey likes carrots, so the donkey moves towards the carrot. And so does the stick and the string and the carrot. The more the donkey moves forward, the more the carrot moves away. Even if the donkey runs after that carrot, it's still about 2 foot in front. You can see it, smell it, it's almost there, but you can't never reach it. And that's how they get donkeys to move carts and people. Does that have any similes for you in your life? Happiness? Deep meditation, you can see the limiter there. You just go, you smell it. You go towards it, it goes away. Whatever else you want in life, the happiness, fulfillment, everything is always a little bit further away, and you just go to get it and it moves away from you. So, how does a donkey catch the carrot? If the donkey had ever paid attention during the retreats, the donkey would know how to catch carrots, the easiest thing in the world. You little donkeys. I've been running after nimittas and jhanas and nice meditation insights for the last 6 or 7 days. Is it 6 days or something? Anyway, I don't know. Have you got them yet? So what do? Stop, yeah. I said that simile yesterday with a little novice. When is Ajahn Chah going to stop? And the novice said, I will stop. And the novice stopped. This is what happens when you stop chasing all these beautiful meditations. The carrot has been moving in front of you, suddenly stop. The carrot, because of momentum, it will continue moving away from you. When you relax to the max, you think nothing's happened, it's getting worse. At least when I put some effort in, I could stay with my breath, sort of. It wasn't pleasant, but at least I could stay with my breath. Now my mind's all over the place. Now the carrot is going further away from you. But then something amazing happens. The carrot swings so far away, then it stops. It reaches the top of its arc. You don't do anything, you're still standing there, relaxing to the max. And then the carrot starts swinging towards you. And soon it's the usual position, 2 foot in front of your mouth. but now it's coming at top speed towards you. It's weird. You've been chasing it, and now it's chasing you. Remember those times I said, don't go looking for the breath, wait for the breath to come to you. That's like what's happened, the breath is swinging towards you. But it's more than the breath, nimittas and jhanas and everything. And you always must remember the last instruction. So yes, sit perfectly still under the mango trees, but open up the hand of compassion. So what happens when the carrot comes close enough? Have you ever seen, like, donkeys? They've got such huge teeth. What the donkey has to remember is as the carrot comes really close, he says, carrot, the door of my mouth is open to you. He opens his mouth so the carrot can come in, otherwise it just bounces off its teeth. So that bit of compassion is also really important, crucial. And that's how people often get their first deep meditation experiences. They go chasing it, and then they stop, they give up. They let go. Swings away, then swings back towards you. So that's a lovely simile, and it's the insight into how these things happen. And some people know how to stop, but they don't know how to stop long enough. I remember doing that, you know, you're really relaxing, and then a nice nimitta comes up. A nimitta coming up. Now I do something. I try to develop the nimitta, or try and go inside it, or just try and do something with it. And that was, you know, a problem for me for a while. I said, no, don't be so stupid. Where did that nimitta come from? Because you were really relaxed to the max. You were peaceful, you were still. And that was the cause of the nimitta. Now, when it's right there in front of you and you just mess it up by wanting to do something, that's really stupid. So then you learned how just to keep doing this relaxing to the max all the way. And then you can get into some really nice deep meditations. Then, of course, relaxing to the max needed that kindness as well. And so often when I used to do this meditation, that sometimes you'd be meditating and you're starting getting peaceful. But then just the whole path when it starts to get very joyful wasn't really happening. And I mention this because many of you mentioned that to me either in the questions or in the interviews. Yeah, you're peaceful. You watch the breath and the breath is disappearing, but basically there's no oomph in the meditation. It's kind of flat. And I remembered that often if I came across a pause or a blockage, or things weren't actually going as they normally went, what I would do is not put forth any effort, because I realised that would always mess things up. I would imagine that I was just standing back a bit and seeing what the problem was. It's like you come across a brick wall in your meditation and you keep banging your head against the wall thinking you can break through. And that's a silly response. It's like that Jewish rabbi goes at that wailing wall in Jerusalem and he's banging his head against that wall. And that's because that's one of their traditions. And the reporter said, what are you doing? He said, I'm trying to find world peace. Have you found world peace? He said, no, it's like banging my head against the wall. That's a joke. Okay, anyway. Back to the Dhamma talk. So that's sometimes what you do. Crash against the wall, trying to use your force to break through. But instead you have an idea of just standing back a little bit. And then you find to the left there's a door which is open, you can just walk through. To the right there's a ladder you can just climb over. And if you actually stand back even further, you find that's the amount of length the wall goes. The government couldn't afford to finish it, so to the right and to the left it's empty. No wall at all. This is actually through the wisdom You can find so many ways through these so-called blockages. So this is why we use our wisdom. But in particular, just I'm not quite sure about you, but I always found the biggest hindrance which I have was amazingly, the ill will. And so it was the kindness which was the best antidote. So whenever I was blocked anywhere, I'd always remember kindness. Kindness to the whole process. You don't have to get jhanas today, Ajahn Brahm. You don't have to get enlightened. You don't have to do anything. And that kindness, I'd shine that kindness all over. And then usually I'd find the obstacle, the block. And I'd just be kind to it. I never, as they say, kick butt. I never use effort and force. Just use the wisdom power. And then when you saw that, yes. You just need to see it. It's really true. But once you see the obstacle and you give it some more kindness, it vanishes. And you just go much, much deeper, really quickly. You've gone over that obstacle. And I know that some people in a meditation retreat, when they talk about the five hindrances, they tell me they have all the five hindrances at once. That's impossible. You can't. But you talk with them and say, no. They're all together, they're really strong, they're blocking me. It's so hard. This is retreats in the West. But then, of course, you have to find an antidote to that, and the antidote's very easy. And I call it the Nalagiri strategy. Now, to understand what I'm referring to, Nalagiri was this huge elephant. And this is when Devadatta was trying to take over the Sangha from the Buddha. And King Ajatasattu was trying to help him by killing his father, the king. And so somebody, they made this elephant drunk. They gave him some alcohol. And then they let the elephant loose on the path where the Buddha and his monks were walking on arms round. Now in those days, those streets were very narrow. They didn't need to be wide. And so the elephant was running down the street, smashing everything in its path, crashing trees over, smashing people as well, and running, destroying everything in his path. And in the opposite direction, the Buddha was walking calmly on arms round. And the people were running towards the Buddha. Get out of the way, there's a mad elephant coming your direction. Hide, escape, you haven't got much time. And the Buddha kept on walking, mindfully and slowly. Now, according to the story, there were many monks with the Buddha. And most of those monks, they jumped over the walls and went inside the doors of the houses, they hid. Because that story was also brought up in the points of, Milindapanha. Later on, where King Milinda, a long time afterwards, asked the monks, these were supposed to be enlightened monks. Why did they run away and jump over the walls or climb up the trees or go in the houses? And then this monk, a very good monk, said, they weren't scared. They knew they had to do that because if they hadn't, you wouldn't have actually seen the real beautiful part of this story where just Ananda and the Buddha face this elephant. It's a nice excuse. But anyway, it left just Ananda, the Buddha's faithful disciple, and the Buddha facing this huge, mad, powerful, destructive monster of an elephant, running at full speed, drunk. And then next thing which happened, Ananda, He loved the Buddha so much, he went and stood in front of the Buddha. Let the elephant take me. I will give my life for my teacher. And at this point, I usually say, if that was me, how many of you... okay. So the Buddha just pushed Ananda out of the way. He says, very nice, but like, I can handle this. And so it was just the Buddha and the mad elephant. Like, you know, some of those confrontations. When I was a kid, it used to be this movie called High Noon, where the hero and his villain, they were walking together for a shootout with guns. And who was going to win? This was the Buddha versus Nadagiri. What would the Buddha do? Now, I think you all know, and I understand, the Buddha had such enormous psychic powers. The Buddha could have very easily grabbed Nadagiri by the trunk. Didn't matter how heavy Nadagiri, the mad elephant, was. Swung him around his head three times. Which of things three times? And then thrown him over the Ganges River a couple of hundred miles away. That would be easy. But that's not what the Buddhas do. They're much more powerful than that. The Buddha gave this elephant loving kindness. Something like, you know, looking at Nadagiri, the mad, crazy elephant. Nadagiri, the door of my heart will always be open to you. Even if you pick me up with your trunk and smash me against the wall. If you trample me with your feet, no matter what you ever do, if you gore me with your tusks, no matter what you ever do, I'll always be your friend. The door of my heart's always open to you. But no, 100 times more powerful than that. What is the result of that? The result was, according to the story, that Nadagiri stopped. He bowed his head down to the Buddha, and the Buddha stroked his trunk. There, Nadagiri. There. No guilt, no punishment. Just, you know, somebody exploited you. Nadagiri just was a nice, calm, peaceful elephant now. So if any of you who live in Perth, we're visiting Northbridge on a Saturday night. Somebody wants to wash you with a gun. There. The door of my heart's open to you. You know, sometimes that happens. I always remember this story. It was not a Buddhist monk, it was like a Hindu holy man. Decided to walk home when he was giving some talks in New York. And he went to some of the bad places in New York. And so he was just walking home, minding his own business. And his gang of youths came up to him, took out their knife, give us your wallet, Mac or something. Hey, I'm not Mac. And he said, I don't have any money. Said this Hindu holy man. Said, look, don't give us that. Let's see your wallet. Said, I don't have one. I'm a Hindu sage. I don't have any money. My job is just to give. And give kindness. And apparently he talked like this. It was reported in the New York Times the following day. He talked so nicely to these thugs that after a while the thugs said, I'm sorry, sir. We made a mistake. Have a nice evening, sir. And the thing which the New York Times reporter was so surprised at, as these thugs called this little Hindu Indian man, sir. They couldn't harm him at all. Or, shall I tell my story? Of course I'm going to tell it. This was not Nadagiri, it was a group of young men. And Now, I grew up in the town of Acton in West London. The west part of Acton was quite wealthy, but where I grew up was really poor. I never realized that until I went to school and realized there were so many migrants in that school. It was a poor area. And so I knew the place. And later on, when I was a monk, I was visiting my mother, and I was walking from my mother's apartment over to the Sri Lankan temple in Chiswick. I knew the street so well. I grew up there. It was my area. And so I was walking, and at first I thought I should have known better, because I was walking down the street where there was one of these, they called them sink estates. You know, these housing blocks for very poor people, lots of crime, lots of drugs, and what even the police didn't like going inside. There were sort of danger zones, no-go areas. And as I was walking down this road, it was called Acton Lane, I still remember the name of it, past the South Acton housing estates, there was a group of young men. They were just gathering there in the evening, just meeting each other, going to be up to no good. And there's about maybe a dozen of them. And they were maybe 16 or something, maybe 15, I'm not sure. And I was walking towards them with a bald head, brown robes. So they looked at me. They were just up to some mischief. So when they started looking at me, they started chanting, Buddha, 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 trying to intimidate me. I did have a choice. I could cross to the other side of the road. I could turn back. I could go another path. But stupid Ajahn Brahm, I sound stupid. I was pushing my luck. Pushing luck? I don't really think so. So I carried on walking towards them. And the closer I got, the louder they chanted, and the more intimidating the chanting became. Buddha! 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 And it was about, again, about 14 of them. And now, I am not a fit, no, I am fit, but, you know, I can't run fast, and I don't know how to fight. But nevertheless, as I got closer, you know what I did? I made a kung fu pose. I've never in my life done kung fu. The only place I learned that from was this TV series called Kung Fu, starring David Carradine. I used to watch that when I was a school teacher. I thought it was really cool. That's what I can remember. And I walked straight towards these guys. Buddha, Buddha, Buddha. You know what they did? They parted and let me walk right through them. They never harmed me at all. Well, you can see a bald head, brown robe. I looked the part, even though I wasn't. So anyway, the Nadagiri strategy, the kindness was what subdued the elephant. So when this guy came up and said he had an attack of all the hindrances, Nadagiri's strategy, no matter what hindrance it is, or altogether, no matter how strong, hindrances, the door of my heart is open to you. You can destroy my meditation and send me mad so I have to be committed to a mental institution for the rest of my life. You can smash me to bits and so I have to, you know, be in an ordinary hospital for years. But hindrances, the door of my heart's open to you. May you have a wonderful day. That is a powerful antidote. The kindness. And the hindrances can't harm you. It's weird. Try it. If you want an insurance policy beforehand, Adam, if it doesn't work, can you pay my medical bills afterwards? Sure, because it does work. So that's one of the insights you have, the power of loving kindness, not force, but softness. You're so soft that nothing can bruise you. It's a beautiful way of living too. And it means that when you're meditating, you get this insight of being so kind to your body, so kind to your mind. I'm already over time. Just a quick one. You know, some people often ask, so when they're meditating, half an hour, 40 minutes has gone past, and their leg hurts. What should you do? Just to endure, or just to change your posture slightly? From what I've just said, and I'll give you a strategy, what should you do? Change your posture slightly. Because if you carry on, a lot of time that ache, that pain will get worse and worse and worse and destroy the happiness of the meditation. So instead it hurts slightly, just move it. Only slowly and slightly. It does disturb the progress of your meditation. You maybe go back 5 minutes from where you were 5 minutes ago. But then from there, now you're comfortable. You soon make up that 5 minutes and you can go deeper without any obstacle. It's worth it. The kindness and compassion in your meditation is really, really powerful. And you get to the last day of the retreat and nothing's happening. Oh my goodness. This is... How many retreats have you done, Prem? Uncountable. I don't know. It doesn't matter. You get to that time of your retreat and you be kind to yourself. Maybe I haven't got limiters, but I've had a nice, peaceful time. Heard a lot of good Dhamma, eaten a lot of delicious food, rested, relaxed. This is enough for me. And anyone who thinks like that, this is good enough, this is enough for me. That's when the limiters realize, oh, this is the place where we should go, to someone like that. And you get all these beautiful fruits falling into your hands. All these carrots you've been chasing start to come into your mouth. And you think, this is ridiculous. I've been struggling all week, and now I give up, and now it all happens. That's how it works. Sadhu! 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 Okay, hope you enjoy that. Now we have interviews. So this afternoon there's going to be a meeting. I think you've been warned. A meeting in my cave. Just after 1 o'clock. For everybody who's signed up there. 30 people, isn't it? Excellent. So, we've always seen how many people we can fit into the cave. So, see if we can get the record. Only 3 at a time? No, I can get at least 10 at a time. No, whatever. But you know, this group of school kids from Christchurch College came in once because they enjoyed the talk which I gave to them in their school. And you know what they said about my cave? They said this would be an excellent place for a rave. So I hope they're not coming today. Okay. Have a nice meditation if you wish.